We were talking yesterday about Parshas Toldos and about the brachos and the like. And because of this, you know, Yaakov is given an instruction to run away. Now it's very, very interesting that even then, Rivka's reason, in other words, if we were to ask, why was Yaakov told to leave Eretz Yisrael and go to Padan Aram? The reason Rivka tells Yaakov is, your life is in danger, Esav wants to kill you, you have to get out of here, why shall I lose both of my sons on the same day? What does she mean, lose both of my sons? Because if Esav kills you, I've lost you, and if Esav becomes a murderer, I've lost him, because that's the end. Right? So she emphasizes the pikuach nefesh. Now, when she talks to her husband Yitzchak, she doesn't say Esav wants to kill Yaakov. She doesn't say that. She just says, no, listen, it is disgusting to me that my children should marry Canaanite women. Esav already did it. Let's send Yaakov to my brother, where he can marry a woman from the family, just as I was a woman from that family. So it's interesting that Yitzchak is not even informed that Esav wants to kill Yaakov. Like, why couldn't Rivka tell Yitzchak of that? It could be that, once again, in spite of everything, Yitzchak has a certain love for Esav, and maybe Yitzchak wouldn't believe it. In other words, if Rivka were to say Esav wants to kill Yaakov and therefore Yaakov has to run, Yitzchak might say, that's impossible. I know they don't get along, I know they're not best friends, but I cannot believe the idea that Esav would kill Yaakov. Consistent with the fact that Esav, number one, was meticulous in Kibud Aviyim, and consistent with the fact that Yitzchak feels that Esav would not do something that would hurt Yitzchak. So Memela, Rivka had to pitch it in a different way. Yeah.
It might seem like a silly question, but why can't he just tell him, like, if Rivka knew he would have killed Yaakov, and he was bold for Kibbutz Aveim, then just say, don't kill your brother.
Yeah.
And if he had Kibbutz Aveim, wouldn't he be able to do anything? Like,
yeah, well,
like, they not listen to their parents?
Well, yeah, but the answer, yeah, you're right, but the answer is that everything has its boundary, and the concept is that, you know, since Esav is not intrinsically a tzaddik, Esav has this one mitzvah, but if push comes to shove and his anger is great enough, then everything will be thrown away. You know, without Yiras Hashem, even your natural morality succumbs to your temptations and to your taivas and to your anger. Now, you do know there's a famous medrash that Esav had a son, Eliphaz. And when Yaakov was escaping, Eliphaz initially wanted to kill Yaakov as a shaliach of his father. But instead, Eliphaz became a Baal Tshuva and said, well, listen, I have to listen to my father who said to kill you. That's my Kibbutz Aviyim. But instead, I will take all of your money, all of your possessions, based on the idea that a poor person is treated like a dead person. So Eliphaz could report to his father, I did kill Yaakov, I took away all of his wealth, and the like. Now, this Eliphaz has a very interesting history, both for good and for bad. It is recorded, Eliphaz took a maidservant from Mitzrayim, Timna, and from his relationship with that concubine or maidservant, he had a son, Amalek. So the nation of Amalek comes from Eliphaz and Timna, which is Amalek, of course, is the root of all of this evil in the world. Amalek is connected to the Nachash, to the snake. But Eliphaz makes another appearance in a very strange way. All of you have heard of the book of Eov, the book of Job. And Eov describes a righteous man who all of a sudden is suffering, and he's trying to understand, why is Hashem bringing all of this suffering on him? And Eov has three friends who come to visit him. And the friends offer different types of answers and the like. And the friend that is the senior friend, and the one who speaks the most, his name is Eliphaz. Now, it doesn't say he's the son of Esav at all, and you don't have to say that. But there are many Midrashim and Chazal that say that this great Eliphaz, who is a philosopher and a Yirei Elokim, and tries to communicate what you might call the idea that God is perfect and God is just and God doesn't do wrong and God will forgive you if you do tshuva. Chazal say that Eliphaz is none other than this same Eliphaz, son of Esav, who became a Baal Tshuva. Let me point out that according to many opinions, Eov is not necessarily Jewish. Eov is described as living in the land of Utz. Now, Utz is not where they made potato chips. Utz is actually one of the lands of Esav. Esav is described as living in Utz, right? So, as a result, Eov himself might be an Edomite, and Eliphaz became one of the wise men of Edom, who gave Eov counsel. So it's interesting that in the merit of his rachamim on Yaakov Avinu, Eliphaz himself was zocheh to a high level of chachma and the like. So it's interesting how the same personalities can resurface in different contexts and the like. That's why in the book of Eov, you'll see that the book of Eov never talks about Torah and mitzvos. It talks about fearing God. It talks about being just. In other words, it's not written, it's part of Tanakh, of course, but it's not written as a specifically Jewish book. And many say Eov was a non-Jew. In fact, that's Rashi's opinion in Chumash, that when Yoshua and Kalev were trying to calm down the Meraglim, who are saying the land is so fearsome. So Kalev's argument was, their protector has died. There is nothing to fear. Rashi says Eov was living in Canaan still, and Eov died, and therefore he was no longer the tzaddik that could protect them. So Rashi clearly says that Eov was a non-Jew who lived in the lands of Canaan, and therefore it's entirely plausible that Eliphaz was indeed Esav's son. Now, there's one thought, though, about this idea of Amalek that Rav Chaim Shalevitz used to bring, which is a very, very powerful thought. What is the story? Timnah was actually a princess, similar to Hagar. Hagar was also a Bas Melech. And Timnah, like Hagar, wanted to be Mizdabek in the seat of Avram. She wanted actually to be taken as a concubine by Yaakov Avinu. She was rejected by Yaakov as not being worthy, for whatever the reason. And as a result, she said, if I cannot connect to the holy part of the family of the Avos, I will connect to Esav. So she went to Esav because she was rejected by Yaakov, and this was her desire to be Mizdabek in the seed of Abraham. Even though she was a princess, she was royalty. And she became a maidservant, she became a shifcha, she became a lowly slave, because she so much wanted to connect to the Zera Avram, even the bad part of the Zera Avram, Esav. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, Amalek is born from rejection. When a person wants to serve Hashem, and they get rejected, they get pushed away, rejection can cause the biggest evil to come out, and that is Amalek. He said this very practically. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, as you know, was the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir, both in Europe and then in Eretz Yisrael. A very, very great man. Many of the Rebbeim and Or Sameach were Talmidim, our Talmidim, of Rav Chaim Shmulevitz. And Rav Chaim Shmulevitz had a shita, and again, I'm not giving you halacha l'maisa on this, that he would almost never kick a boy out of yeshiva. He would never ask a bachur to leave yeshiva. Even if the guy wasn't learning, even if the guy wasn't doing anything, he was just wasting time, seemingly. Because, unless he was a bad influence on other people, that was a separate cheshbon. If he was a negative influence on other people, that's a separate thing. But Rav Chaim Shalevitz said, you never know what rejection can do to a person. A person who is rejected from Kedusha develops a hate and an animosity and an anger that could be uncontrollable. So in many ways, now this is not blaming the victim. In other words, Rav Chaim Shalevitz is not saying, oh, let's excuse Amalek. Amalek had an abused childhood, or whatever it is, or Hitler, you know, they didn't buy his paintings, so he became, you know, such a bad guy. Of course, people are responsible for their rishus, and the Torah itself says there's a mitzvah to eradicate Amalek. We don't have compassion for Amalek. But he's offering a perspective that to some degree we have an achrayus for the creation of the amaleks in the world by the rejection that we have. So that's an important idea to think about, you know, when you become parents and you, let's say, hope not, but sometimes you might be dealing with what they call kids at risk or kids off the derech or all sorts of different types of complications, that to recognize that there needs to be a great amount of love and acceptance, because when there is rejection, that can turn into hate of Yiddishkeit and hate of Kedusha, and that can become the most bitterest enemy. And Rav Chaim Shalevitz used to say that was the lesson of Amalek. Now again, as I say, when somebody's a negative hashpah on other people, you got to do what you got to do, because you have to protect everybody else. Same thing within a home, that can happen as well. But even then, I know of a yeshiva that specializes in difficult guys, and when they have to ask people to leave, the Rosh Yeshiva says to the person, he says, "This is not your fault. It's our fault. It's our fault that we were not wise enough and good enough to be able to help you with your particular struggles. So this was our failing, and we hope that we can find a place for you that would be good." That's a very, very interesting way of putting it. Meaning, it's not you're a bad person. It's we were not great enough to be able to help you with your particular problem. I'll tell you a maisa with the Chafetz Chaim. It's a great maisa that actually there are two separate stories. I'm not sure if it's, I'm going to tell you two stories. I'm not sure if they're the same story or two different stories with two different guys. But there are two stories that are very similar. Story number one is a kid was caught in Radin smoking on Shabbos in Radin. So he was sent to the Chafetz Chaim. Now, the Chafetz Chaim was not the Rosh Yeshiva Rabbi, but the Chafetz Chaim was the Gadol Ador, and he was the spiritual presence of the world. And the boy was shaking and shivering and frightened. He had to approach the Chafetz Chaim. And he goes into the Chafetz Chaim, and the Chafetz Chaim says, "You have to leave the yeshiva. You can't be in the yeshiva anymore. Bacharim see that you are Mechalel Shabbos. And you can't be here anymore." So as the bacher was leaving, so the Chafetz Chaim said, "Where are you going?" And the bacher said, "Well, the Rebbe said I'm kicked out of yeshiva." So the Chafetz Chaim said, "Just because you can't be in the yeshiva doesn't mean you can't stay in my house, and I'll learn with you. I don't want you to be with the guys because you're a bad influence. But you're a Yid, you're a Jewish neshama, and I'm going to learn with you." So he actually lived in the Chafetz Chaim's house, and the Chafetz Chaim was his chavrusa. Now, you might say, "Hey, that's an example of bad behavior getting the ultimate reward. Hey, you know, I'm Mechal Shabbos, I get to learn with the Chafetz Chaim. That's one way of getting a Seder." On the other hand, I want to tell you, learning with the Chafetz Chaim might not be so easy. You know, you can't really be late. You can't be Mavatal. You know, it's not the easiest thing to learn with the Chafetz Chaim. But that's one story. Now, there's another story, and I'm not sure if it's the same guy in the continuation of the same story, that a rabbi was once speaking in Miami, and he was talking about the idea. Somebody asked him, "How do you motivate people to change their lives?" And the person said, "If I only knew how to motivate people to change their lives." And he said a story. I'll tell you a story of the Chafetz Chaim, and I don't know what the Chafetz Chaim said, that there was a boy who was Mechal Shabbos. Again, I don't know if it's the same story. And the Chafetz Chaim called him in, and the Chafetz Chaim spoke to him for 30 seconds. And that changed the person's life. He became a Shomer Shabbos. And the rabbi said, "If I only knew what the Chafetz Chaim said or did, that changed the person's life." So from the back of the hall, an old man, 95 years old, gets up on a cane and says, "I am the man, I am the boy." This never happens to me, but it's happening now. "I am the boy, and I'll tell you what the Chafetz Chaim said." And he says, "I walk into the Chafetz Chaim, I'm 15 years old. And I'm taller than the Chafetz Chaim. Is very short. Chafetz Chaim is very short. And he looks up at me. And I see the blue eyes, very deep blue eyes. And there are tears in the eyes. And he takes my two hands. He takes my hand in his two hands. And he looks at me. And he's crying. And he says, Shabbos. And I realized, I saw the love that the Chafetz Chaim had for me and how much pain he was in that I was Mechalel Shabbos. And I felt his tears burn a hole into my, like hot tears, as if it was burning a hole into my hand. And I said, I could never do that to the Chafetz Chaim again. And then I thought, and how does the Ribbono Shel Olam feel if that's what the Chafetz Chaim feels? Right? This is a microcosm of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's pain. And that changed me. Now again, I don't know if it's the same person, same story, but these are two stories they tell about the Chafetz Chaim. But again, the idea of loving people, of accepting people, is a very big yesod. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, this is the shayrish of Amalek in the world, came from Timna's rejection. Yeah.
So you said earlier that Rivka didn't want, would lose both her sons if he so killed Jacob.
Yep.
But why would she lose Esau? He had already killed like Nimrod and other people, so like...
Yes, but number one, killing, I mean, all murder is bad, but killing a tzaddik, who is the one that was destined to fulfill God's purpose of creation, that would be monumental. That would be like destroying the universe.
So she thinks like God would come.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I also want to tell you that Rashi brings a very interesting medrash, that this was an unintentional prophecy in Rivka's mouth, that Yaakov and Esav would die the same day. And indeed, that did happen. Many years later, many years after Rivka's death, when Yaakov died at 147, Esav also died at 147. They came into the world the same day. They actually died the same day. And Rivka didn't even realize she was uttering the prophecy, why shall I lose both of you the same day? In fact, that is exactly what happened. So, now I want to discuss a little bit of a chronology. Rashi at the end of Toldos gives us a very, very intricate chronological sequence which is taken from the end of the first perek of Megillas Esther. And it's very important that you know this chronology because it is a great mafteach, it is a great key to understand some very important points. When you read the Chumash, Yaakov seems to have traveled straight from Eretz Yisrael to Lavan's house. Right? That's his next stop. There is no intermediate stop other than his dream, etc. But he doesn't stop anywhere. And yet, according to Chazal, there was actually a 14-year detour before he went to Lavan's house. Now, it's important to know that is not recorded in the Chumash. The Chumash does not say there was any significant detour. He's traveling and he has a dream and then he goes on. Chazal say, and they prove, a 14-year detour. And what was that 14-year detour? That before Yaakov went to Lavan's house, he went to the great yeshiva of Shem, that was Noach's son, and Aver, who was Shem's grandson. In other words, these are people who are before Avram. Right? Shem and Aver, before Avram. Shem was actually not alive anymore, but Aver was they called it the yeshiva of Shem and Aver, but Aver was still alive. And Yaakov spent 14 years learning in Shem v'Aver. Now, what did he learn? Again, this is always an interesting question. I mean, there was no Gemara per se, right? He didn't learn Bava Metzia and the like. But he learned what you might call godliness. Maybe the closest thing would be mysticism, Kabbalah. And that he learned about Hashem. And Yaakov needed this because before he confronts the corruption and the perversity and the dishonesty in Lavan's house, Yaakov is deathly afraid. This is the frying pan and the fire. Because in Eretz Yisrael, he's threatened with his physical life. Esav will kill him. In Lavan's house, bereft of the holiness of Eretz Yisrael, bereft of Yitzchak and Rivka, Yaakov is afraid that spiritually he will be corrupted and destroyed. And in many ways, that's even worse. And if Yaakov goes, there goes the Jewish people. And if there goes the Jewish people, there goes the world, there goes the universe. So Yaakov needed 14 years of the yeshiva of Shem and Aver to fortify himself. Now the obvious question is, 14 years in Shem V'Avram, he's coming from Yitzchak's house. He's coming from the house of Avram Yitzchak. Now remember too, that Avram himself did not die until Yaakov and Esav were 15 years old. So Yitzchak, Yaakov and Esav both knew Avram. So Yitzchak had the first 15 years with the influence of Avram. Sarah died before Yitzchak was born. Sarah died before Yaakov was born. Yeah, obviously. Sarah died before Yaakov was born, but Yitzchak knew Avram. And Yitzchak learned, Yaakov knew Avram, and Yaakov learned from Yitzchak. So what does the yeshiva of Shem V'Aver have to offer that Yaakov didn't get from his parents' house? Yeah.
We learned that the chiddush of Abraham is that he was the first to like posit monotheism throughout the world, but if you already have this academy, you already have the idea of monotheism.
Yep. Yeah, that's a very excellent question. That's another question, but let me address that question. That is, Shem and Aver are earlier than Abraham. Do you want to answer that? Yeah.
Because Abraham was a combination of spirituality and physicality, whereas Shem and Aver taught merely the spiritual aspects.
Yeah.
And so he could build up his emunah through the spirituality solely, and he could combine that with his understanding from Abraham, which was the combination of spiritual.
You're answering my question, not his. You're asking his question or my question? You're asking my question. Yeah, very good point. I'll get back to it. Let me just talk about his question first. Yeah, so the answer is Shem and Aver did teach monotheism. They did teach godliness, but only to those who came to them. They were an academy. They followed Noach's philosophy. What was Noach's philosophy? He built the ark, and anybody who wanted to know about it could ask. But Noach, remember the Zohar false Noach, for not going out and trying to change his generation. The greatness of Abraham was not so much what he knew. There were other people who knew that there was one God, and there were even people who taught there was one God. But Abraham was proactive in spreading godliness throughout the world. So that's why Abraham is unique. But the question then becomes, and that's what you just said, the question then becomes, what was special about Shem V'Aver? That Yaakov needs 14 years of Shem V'Aver when he was living his whole life in Avram, with Avram, and with, especially with Yitzchak and Rivka. So you wanted to answer that Shem V'Aver was the world of pure spirituality. They removed themselves from the world, as opposed to the others that were involved in the world. And Yaakov needed, you're suggesting, a prolonged period of pure oxygen, meaning away from bad influences, because even in the Abbas's house, there were idol worshippers who would come in, etc. He needed to get away from it all. Okay, that's one approach. I hear what you're saying. That's a very interesting thought. Rav Huttner gives a different answer. Rav Huttner says that Shem and Aver would teach him the Torah of Chutz La'aretz, and the Avos taught him the Torah of Eretz. What does that mean? Avram was different than Yitzchak. Avram grew up in an idolatrous, corrupt society, but Yitzchak did not. So Yaakov was not raised as a Baal Shuvah, so to speak. Yaakov was raised in a totally godly environment. But Yaakov is now relocating to an environment of godlessness, of paganism, of immorality, of evil. He's not sure that he has the survival techniques of navigating that. But Shem and Aver, these are the people who remembered the flood. They also were raised in that environment. In a way, had Avram still been alive, Avram might have taken the place. Avram could have given him the Shem and Aver input. But Yitzchak could not, because Yitzchak was born into holiness. And because Yitzchak was born into holiness, he raised Yaakov in holiness, although there was Esav. But that does not automatically give you the ability to confront a world which lacks holiness. And therefore he needed Shem and Aver for the survival skills of living in a makom tamei and living in an impure, decadent, corrupt environment. This was the yeshiva of Chutz La'aretz. So this is not even recorded in the Chumash, but there were 14 years. Now, the Gemara in Megillah makes an excellent, beautiful point. If you look at the Chumash, how many years was Yaakov away from the land of Israel? Just look at the Chumash. You come up with 22 years. We can prove this because 7 years he worked for Lavan in order to marry Leah. Well, to marry Rachel, but he got Leah. Then he worked another 7 years to get Rachel. That's 14 years. Then he worked another 6 years to build up his fortune. So that's 20 years. And then we are told it took 2 years, for whatever reason, for the way back. So, sach hakol, Yaakov was gone, if you don't count the 14 years, I'll get to that. Yaakov was gone 22 years. Now, if we add the extra 14 years of Shem V'Eber, Yaakov was away 36 years. Yitzchak was still alive when he came back. Remember, Yitzchak is alive. He sees Yitzchak when he gets back. Now, Yosef was sold later. Yosef was sold when he was 17 years old. Yaakov was reunited with Yosef when Yosef was 30 years old. This is in the Chumash. So how many years was Yaakov separated from Yosef? 22 years. 17 to 30. Actually 23 years, but we say he had finished his 17th year. Huh? 17 to 39. I want to be corrected. Yosef stood before Pharaoh at 30, but then you had the 7 years of famine. I'm sorry, 7 years of plenty. And Yaakov came in this after 2 years of famine. So 30, 7, and 2. That's 22 years. Okay, now there's, again, let me repeat this. Yosef was sold at 17. And Yaakov did not see Yosef till Yosef was 39 years old. Okay, because Yosef was 30 when Paro had his dreams. Right after the dreams are the 7 years of plenty. And then 2 years into the 7 years of famine is when Yaakov came down. 30 plus 7 plus 2. So, here is what Chazal say. The 22 years that Yaakov did not honor his father because he was away from his father, Yosef was taken away from him for those 22 years. The same way he did not honor his father for 22 years, Yosef did not honor. Now, l'chor, you might say, that implies that Yaakov's absence was sinful. But what do you mean? Yaakov was told to go by both his father and his mother. But still, even though his leaving was justifiable, l'maisa, he did not fulfill kibud aviyim for those 22 years. Now, Chazal say the following. This is a great mamash. But wait a second. If we posit, I didn't give you the proof yet, but if we posit that in addition to the 22 years, there was 14 years of shame behavior, then why is Yaakov only punished for the 22 years? He should be punished for the 36 years. So the Gemara in Megillah says, we see from here that the mitzvah of Talmud Torah is so great that it overrides kibud av v'aim. So for the 14 years that he was in the yeshiva of Shem V'Eiver, that does not count as a demerit. He was gone for 36 years, but he's punished with Mechiras Yosef for only 22 years, because the 14 years of Shem V'Eiver are Talmud Torah, and Talmud Torah is greater than kibud av v'aim. Now this has implications, this has practical implications, although they're a bit tricky. That is, if my parent tells me not to study Torah, the mitzvah, now again, there may be reasons why I should listen to my parents. There may be economic reasons and the like, but in terms of kibud aviyeh, you absolutely don't have a mitzvah, do not have a mitzvah of kibud aviyeh to stop your Torah learning. Again, that doesn't mean you don't listen to your parents. Again, people have to have common sense here. There are a lot of reasons why a person should listen to his parents. Sometimes the parents may be right, you know, the cheshvan. But all I'm saying is, there's no automatic veto idea that because it's kibud aviyeh, I got to do it. And in fact, according to halacha, it's brought down that even if your parents want you to learn, but they want you to learn in a different yeshiva, and you have concluded that another yeshiva is the best yeshiva for you. Once again, obviously, whenever your parents tell you anything, you should listen to it, weigh it, think about it, don't dismiss it, God forbid. But all I'm saying is, if after all of the discussion, you are convinced with Das Torah that a given yeshiva is the right place for you, kibud aviyeh is not mechayev you to even switch yeshivas, because every yeshiva is different, every rebbe is different, and the like. Of course, it's also brought down that your parents don't have to pay tuition, meaning the following. If your parents feel a certain yeshiva is better for you, but you feel with your rebbeim that it's not, so you can make your decision and they can make their decision. They have the same freedom, right, to make their decision, not to listen to you, as you have not listened to them. So it's brought down really specifically that there are three major areas where kibud aviyeh is not an override. One is Talmud Torah. The second is making aliyah, moving to Israel. That is allowed to move to Eretz Israel even over parental objection. Now, I'm not dealing with the issue of elderly parents, that's a separate question, but if parents simply say, I don't want you to move, you can still move. And the third, which is very interesting, is shiduchim. Now, again, I don't want to be misunderstood. In every shidduch, you try very, very hard to get your parents' blessing. You know, you need a relationship. And if your parents feel the shidduch is not good, take it seriously. Don't dismiss it. Please don't misunderstand me. Take it very, very seriously. But all I'm saying is, if after taking it seriously, and if after talking to chachamim and tzaddikim, it is clear to you that this is the right person, then the halacha says you go ahead, even if it's over your parents' objection. But as I say, that's really, really only a last resort. But halachically, that is exactly what you do. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't understand. So Yaakov was sent to go find a wife at Laban's house. So how was he working for Laban to get his wife, dishonoring his mother and father?
No. So that's a good question. Remember, he was sent by his mother and father, right? They said to go. But the answer is this. You have to understand, it's not so much that he's being punished. He's not being punished because he's doing what he's supposed to do. But he didn't have the merit of actively serving his father. So even though you're doing what your father wants you to do, but the lack of proximity means that you're not actually able to give him a cup of coffee, you're not able to walk with him. In other words, you're lacking a spiritual merit of actively assisting him. And that's the highest level of kibud aviyeh. The highest level of kibud aviyeh is when you can be personally involved in taking care of your parents.
So what would it have been better for him to say, I'm not going to go to London so I can serve you here?
Well, that wouldn't have been good either, because they told him to go. Now, you have to understand that this is a complicated idea that's not so easy to absorb. Sometimes, even when you do what you have to do, you suffer for it. We think, as long as you're doing the right thing, everything should be good. The answer is no. You're doing the right thing, but you're sacrificing something very, very special. And that could hurt you. Even though you have to take the hurt. You have to take the hurt. You know, it's hard for us to understand that. But certainly, Yaakov went where he had to go. Absolutely. And the like. By the way, one other thing in the parsha, just this is very obvious, and if you read the Chumash, you know this, but a lot of people misunderstand because they know the Bible story. All of us know the story that he wanted to marry Rachel, and he worked 7 years for Rachel, and then the wedding night came, and it was pitch dark, and Lavan made a switcheroo, and he winds up with Leah in the morning. So Lavan then says, kind of a classic line of blaming Yaakov, he says, you know, in our place, like Lavan is the principal's man, Lavan says, I don't know where you come from, Yaakov. But in our place, we don't marry off the younger before the older. Meaning, you see what Levin is being very sarcastic. You take the bracha from your older twin, Esav. Esav is a little older, but we have higher morals. You know, it would have been interesting. Why couldn't Levin tell him that 7 years before? You know, he waited 7 years and then switched. So then, the agreement is, Yaakov works another 7 years for Rachel. So a lot of people misunderstand this. A lot of people think he didn't marry Rachel till after the second 7 years. That is not true. He married Rachel 1 week later. He got Rachel on credit. Leah, in other words, he didn't marry Leah. He didn't marry Leah till he worked 7 years. Then they had 7 days of a wedding celebration. After 7 days, he married Rachel and then worked 7 years. So remember that the difference in their wedding dates is only 1 week. And it's interesting that the Gemara learns halachas from Lavan's behavior. What is the halacha? That we don't mix two joys. That since after a wedding we have 7 days of rejoicing, it's not proper to have another wedding. In other words, at a time when you were allowed to have more than one wife, you don't get married within a week of the first wife, because ein ma'arvin simcha b'simcha. Now, for us, that's not relevant. We don't have polygamy, but except Sephardim. But it is relevant. This is the reason for the halacha why we don't marry during Chol HaMoed. Why can't they make a wedding during Chol HaMoed? Good, on Yom Tov I can't. But why can't they get married in Chol HaMoed? The answer is, since there's a mitzvah to rejoice on the Yom Tov, we don't mix one joy with another joy. So it's interesting that the source of that halacha we learn from Lavan. And one could ask a question, why on earth should Lavan be the source of how we're supposed to behave? Are we looking to Lavan as a role model of behavior? The answer is, you're not really learning it from Lavan. You're learning it from the fact that the Torah bothered to record this detail. Why did the Torah record that they waited a week? Because the Torah is telling us this is a good thing to do. And we're not learning from Lavan waiting a week. We're learning from why Hashem recorded it in the Torah. Yeah.
Does that kind of mean practically that if a person at a time can marry two women at the same time, would that also be considered mixing simchas?
No, that would be equally bad. That would be even worse. That's correct. You cannot mix simcha and simcha.
You can't combine simchas together?
Well, let me put it this way. See, again, you have to define who is the Baal Simcha. For example, if I have two daughters, and they both got engaged at the same time, let's say, I am permitted to make a joint wedding. It doesn't happen that often, but sometimes people do it. There are actually cases where two girls get married the same time. But the reason that's okay is because the simcha is the chasen and the kala. In other words, they are the bali simcha. The parents are indirect. They're one level removed. So the chasen is only marrying one woman. So that's why even after the Holocaust, they had lahavdil, like the Reverend Moon, you know, marries these 10,000 people. Yeah. There were actually Jewish weddings after the Holocaust where many chasanim and kalas got married the same time. But that's not a problem of ein ma'arvin simcha b'simcha, because each chasan is only marrying one kala. But if you were to marry two women, then you would be combining two simchas at the same time. You would not be allowed to do that. By the way, we also learn from Lavan the idea of, not, it doesn't say Sheva Brachas because it doesn't say blessings, but 7 days of rejoicing after a wedding, right? You learn two wedding laws from Lavan. Actually, three wedding laws. Wedding law number one is 7 days of rejoicing. Wedding law number two is you don't combine joys, you don't make a second marriage till more than 7 days. And number three, although Lavan was very dishonest when he said, oh, we don't give the younger before the older, but it's brought down la halacha, if it's possible, you try to marry off your girls, your daughters, in the order of their birth. You try. Sometimes it doesn't work. But in religious homes, particularly in Yerushalayim, you will often see that a younger girl who's ready to get engaged may delay her engagement until the engagement of her older sister, at least if something is on the horizon. And that is paradoxically derived from Laban. So it turns out that we learn laws from bad guys. Not so much because what they do matters, but why the Torah chooses to record it. Laban may have said a lot of things that are not recorded, but if things are recorded, we learn from them. Yeah?
Don't we also learn out the Bedekin that you...
That's correct. That's correct. But Bedekin may be a little earlier, because it may be all the way back from Rivka, that when Rivka saw Yitzchak, she covered her face with a veil. But you're correct. Bedekin comes out, is here as well, but you may see it one generation earlier. But even so, it's from Lavan's household, right? Rivka got the custom from her family, right? Lavan is Rivka's brother. Right? Okay. Okay, we'll stop here. Rabbi Wasserman will be teaching at 12:30, I think, so we have a little break.
Thank you.
Yep.